Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, your humble host, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. So hopefully the sound of my voice is finding things going well for you, and that the weather is not too bad. I know with over here, actually, this past weekend, it was gorgeous. It was 62 degrees and cloudy on Saturday. And on Sunday, it was 64 degrees and sunny, so you can't beat that with a stick, right? And I took advantage on Saturday to pull my front wheels off my car, my Ford Escort, my Ford, a Fiesta. My wife has an Escape. I used to have an Escort, 450,000 miles, but she succumbed to rust. Nothing else succumbed to anything but rust. So the undercarriage, the unibody actually rusted out. I don't even think you could jack it up anymore, but it's got a heart of a lion. The motor, trans, everything is original on it. Heater core, radiator. So, but the old devil of rust got to it. But anyway, my Fiesta was getting a brake noise, and I knew what it was because the same thing would happen to the Escort every once in a while. Was that I historically, the Escort, I used to get 100, well, I could never get 150,000 miles on front brakes. I used to get like 147, 148, 140, so whatever. I mean, I only did like three brake jobs on it with 450,000, or two brake jobs at 450,000 miles. So, but what would happen is that that's one thing that I particularly don't care for about Ford brakes. They stop wonderfully, they great pedal feel, great stopping action, great wear. But it seems that on their front-wheel drive cars, which is not the same with my Ranger pickup truck, the old Ranger pickup truck, not the new one for 2019 and 20, it seems that they don't have a large swept area on the rotor. And what is defined as the swept area is the surface. You could have a big rotor, but if the pad only contacts a certain region, that is defined as the swept area where the pad is actually rubbing and making friction contact onto the rotor. So they don't have a large swept area, which leaves a margin, for lack of better terms, on the perimeter of the rotor, the outside, going towards the outside of the rotor and then towards the hub, but specifically on the perimeter. And because I get a lot of mileage out of my brakes, a good amount of rust builds up there. And then what would happen is that if you're coming down a mountain and you're just gently riding the brakes, you know, controlling the vehicle, you're not smoking, you're riding the brakes, the rotor gets hot, and then the rotor expands from the heat, and then the pad actually starts to rub onto the rusted material because of the expansion of everything from the heat, and then it goes, it sounds like it's metal to metal. And then after the rotor cools off, in a few minutes that noise goes away. So it only happens in a braking situation where you're, let's say, coming down a hill and you're riding the brakes for a little bit of or applying the brakes. I shouldn't say riding them. So it gets to be quite annoying, and I hate that because it's not perfect, and I like my mechanical things perfect, and I knew what it was, so I said to myself, well, it's going to be a nice warm day, let me jack up the car and pull the rotors off. I could lubricate the slide points, follow my own medicine, right, inspect everything, look at it, and I could, ideally, I would want to cut those rotors put him on a lathe and give him a little bit of a kiss, just a kiss, and then a kiss on the friction surface, and then come out and cut the rust off. So, but today, you can't find anybody who wants to cut rotors, and if you do, usually they're a butcher, but they cut the heck out of it, and then they ruin the rotor, or they do a real quick cut, and they don't put a nice pattern on it. My friend Kurt Mesmer, who's an excellent mechanic who works in the Ford dealer I deal with, which is in Washington, New Jersey, Smith Motors, which is about 20 miles away. They cut rotors there, but I don't have the time to jack up the car, pull the rotors off, bring it to Kurt, 20 miles there, leave them there, and he'll do them in his free time, and then come back and forth and whatever. So I just take them off. I take them to the bench grinder, and I don't grind on them. I use the wire wheel. When I wire wheel off the as much rust as I can get, and I take a file, like a bastard cut file, and I use the edge of the file and scrape the rust off, and I doll it up and clean it up, and then I put it back on and lubricate everything and put it back together. So I did that on Saturday, took advantage of the warm weather, because the next couple of months I'm going to, God willing, be on the road quite a bit, not only for business meaning my writing career and my website and podcast, but I usually try to go to a lot of learning sessions or workshops or seminars, whatever you want to call it, during the winter months when they have all of these scheduled. And as I said the other day, farming in New Jersey, you really have to travel to go someplace to learn. So I'll be putting on some mileage. Historically, during the winter, I usually put between 3,000 and 5,000 miles on my little Ford, going to different workshops and seminars. It depends on where I go and whether they get canceled for weather or not, and obviously the distance. So I went to one on Friday, the couple of days before I'm recording this, and before the weekend. I usually try to record the show on Monday, and then it airs on Wednesday. It gives Susan Moore, my web person, the ability, the time to do whatever she needs to do. I always say it that way because I have no idea what she needs to do to make it into a podcast. But when I start this show, I clear my throat, I do everything, I drink water, and then within the first 7.4 minutes or 7 minutes 40 seconds, my throat and sinuses start to act up. So I apologize for that once more. But anyway, so I went to this, I think I lost my train of thought, but I went to this seminar on Friday down in, I forgot where it was, somewhere by Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's about 3.5 hours away, one way. And it was very, 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 very well attended. I would have to say there was close to 600 people. There was at least 500 plus, and it was quite interesting, and it was about feeding. It was a vegetable produce growers, basically the main focus. They had another room that was talking about silage, but I went to the produce and vegetable growers meeting, or session I should say, and it was talking about feeding a crop for taste. And I always felt that was, I didn't word it that way, feeding it for taste, but I always believed that the quality or the taste and the nutrient content of a fruit or vegetable is intrinsically linked to the fertility that it's provided with. Now, I know that there's some genetics taste better than others, but I always felt that it was key to that, and we kind of proved that in an empirical type of way. And for you, and for those that aren't really familiar with that term, no disrespect, but empirical means in real life that you have data. You know, hey, if I punch you in the nose, you're going to punch me in the nose. That's empirical. All right, theoretical would be that if I punch you in the nose, well, then you don't have to necessarily punch me in the nose. There's no nerve reaction that makes you punch the other guy in the nose. So the empirical is the real world experience, the practical application. And I always felt that if you're not fertilizing properly, and I'm not an agronomist, so I don't know anything about fertilizer, not fertilizing properly, that you would have one of the results would be a tasteless, but a fruit with less robust taste. Now, interestingly enough, His speaker was a gentleman from Minnesota, and I forgot his name. There were so many people in there, I got there about 10 minutes late because it took me so long to get there. But they just started the introduction, so I think his name was John something, right? That helps you a lot. John something, 10 million Johns in the country. But anyway, what he was saying, and he did a lot of research on this, and I'm going to, I have his email address, so I will get in contact with him and send him my sweet corn during the first plant, when the first planting comes up, because he's seeing a direct correlation in plants with the taste and the nutrient content of that crop. And he's also seeing that as far as alfalfa is concerned, but obviously he's not eating alfalfa, but he's using a Bricks test on the alfalfa. And I want to use a Bricks test on my corn, and it's always something that I wanted to do. And I queried him about what resolution of the Bricks meter, because as you guys know, that you use a Bricks tester to check antifreeze, to check coolant in an engine. And I have a Bricks tester for that, but I don't think that the resolution is correct. So he said that I would need a Bricks tester that goes between 0 and 32. So that's quite interesting. But anyway, excuse me again, to get back on track, my throat is acting up, to get back on track with this, is that he was saying that he has found a direct correlation in the taste of the fruit and its nutritional content. So arguably, like he said, let's say if you buy a tomato, you have a tomato from your garden, and you slice open the tomato, and the tomato is very bland tasting, doesn't have a lot of robust tomato-y flavor. He says in almost every instance, with rare exception, when he does nutrient testing on that tomato, that the nutrient content will be low. So I thought that's very interesting. That's why I'm going to be sending him my corn, my sweet corn, is that I want to, a Bricks value I could take myself once I buy a refractometer, but I want to check the nutrient content on my corn versus the nutrient content of the corn my wife would buy, the fresh sweet corn in a supermarket in town. And then I will also go around to other farm stands and get some of their corn and then try to test that against mine. And then I would also use that as a marketing tool, not to give someone a black eye, but to be able to actually establish that hopefully our corn has more nutrients in it than the ones that are not as well taken care of or loved during the growing process. But I may be wrong. We will see. But it was very, 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 very interesting. And I'm looking forward to that. And then I'm also looking forward to, on February 6th, I'm going to a soils class with Neil Kinsey. I have Neil Kinsey's book, actually, many years ago when I went to, and this is an aside to this, that the Ag PhD TV show, radio show, the Hefty Brothers, I have an excellent soils clinic. And I saw that they just started to do that again. I went to that soils clinic twice. I went once in Sikeston, Missouri, and the other time was in Missouri, but south of Sikeston. But they're doing it also at their facility in South Dakota. And it's an excellent, excellent, excellent clinic, and I really learned so much from that, and actually went and steered me on the proper road. But anyway, when I went to that clinic the first time, Brian Hefty gave me a Neil Kinsey's book on agronomy, which is excellent. I mean, I did not read it like a novel. I went through different areas and used it as a resource, but it's excellent. So I'm having the opportunity that in about 200, on February 6th, about 200 miles from the farm here, that I will be able to attend the Neil Kinsey seminar. And it's a one-day event, I'm looking forward to it, because I have never met Mr. Kinsey, but I've heard him on the radio, and I've read some of his work, and he seems to be a very, very knowledgeable, not seems, he is a very knowledgeable man, and I'm looking forward to getting some questions about soil testing, not so much soil testing, actual procedure, but fertility and the interaction of the nutrients, excuse me, and the soil and the plant. And so that's basically it. But what I do want to do And hopefully you're going to some seminars and workshops during this winter time. And, you know, please, you know, let me know where you're going. I love feedback from my audience. And because I know that you're out there listening, thank God. I'm very grateful for that. But if you don't hear from anybody, you never know what's going on. And I would love, I'm very, very interested. I'm sincerely interested in all of you. And so send me an email at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And let me know what classes you're taking and whether you're, what you're going to learn this winter time. But I do want to give a shout out to a couple of people today before we get into the show. And the first one I want to shout out to is Mr. Mike Werner. And I believe, if I recall, he's up in Minnesota. And we've communicated, he had a question, I think, a few months back, something about batteries or whatever, and we've communicated through the email. And but he sent me an email the other, well, probably a week or two ago, just around the new year. And he told me, you know, he brought to light something that I didn't think of. And he's enjoying, you know, he's enjoying the bushels and cents segment, which we're going to get to in a couple of minutes, enjoying the bushels and cents segment. But he said to me, you know, and I was looking at it, or I'm looking at it, the impetus for me to do is to show the audience how poor decisions or wrong decisions in the farm shop can, you know, impact your bottom line in a way that you don't even think. And then what he was bringing up also, which was true as an adjunct to that, is he was bringing up the physical stress level of having to deal with a breakdown. And as he said, you know, if you listen to the show and you learn how to avoid a potential mechanical failure, and your neighbors are out planting in a field and you're over there underneath the tractor or the sprayer or the planter or whatever fixing something, that adds a lot of stress. And, you know, and he actually you know, brought to light the stress component and how bushels and cents, and what I'm doing here on the podcast, or what we're doing together collectively, because you're the listener, all right, and what we're doing, it's not my deal, it's your deal, I'm just a caretaker of it, is what we're doing here is that it's not only helping you financially, or the potential to help you financially, everything is a potential, but it is also reducing your stress level. And as he said, you cannot put a bushel's value on that. And I want to thank him very much for giving me that insight, because I really did not look at it that way. I was looking at strictly as a ledger column, not as far as the physical and emotional stress is concerned of having to deal with something like that. But I'd like to also shout out to Kyle Friday, and then Bruce. I'm sorry, Bruce. I know you're a new listener, and I believe that you are from New Hampshire. And Kyle, I believe, is from Michigan. But I'm going to kill your last name, Bruce. So I'm going to try to pronounce it phonetically. Jakubaukas. So it's Jakubaukas. So I think it's Jakubaukas. And a few shows back, Kyle Friday was corresponding with me, and I brought it up on a show, and he had a, I believe it was a Chevy Silverado pickup truck, and he was having a brake pad wear issue. He listened to the podcast on doing a brake job without a brake job, but when he pulled the wheel off, he found on one side he needed a brake job, because the inside pad on the front, the piston side pad of the caliper, was more worn than on the outside pad. And then what I had said on that particular show is that historically that I have found when that happens, that if the outside pad is worn more than the piston pad, it's usually the caliper not floating and not sliding back. And the other side is that I felt that the piston, from my experience, may be sticking, or there may be a hydraulic issue where a line is coming apart or crimped or what have you. And then we'll call you Mr. Bruce. Then Mr. Bruce wrote me a very, very, very excellent letter, a very professional letter, and he has a lot of experience with braking systems. And he felt that it was most likely not a hydraulic issue, as I had thought it may possibly be from my experience. And he said that sometimes he has found that that if the caliper isn't, and I mean hydraulic, it could be the piston physically sticking because of there's rust on the piston that's exposed and the boot is hanging it up, so it may not be going back in the bore. It doesn't necessarily mean to be hydraulic in the master cylinder. But Mr. Jakubaukas said from his experience, he has found that that the caliper may be not floating properly and allowing the piston to go, not let that piston side pad to go back in properly. So, hey, the important thing is Kyle got back to me, I think, over the weekend or the other day, and he said that he put new pads on it, and he did change the rotors. I had said that he could, you know, just have them checked and turned, but he felt the same thing that I did, that he wasn't going to have a person that he was running into issues getting someone he trusted to cut the rotor. So he put new rotors on and new pads, and he said he's going to check back in a couple of months and see what the wear is. So he did push the piston back in the bore. I remember he did say on one of his correspondences that it seemed to go back in the bore easier the second time he did it than the first time, and I don't know whether that has any value or not. I'm not denying that. And then he'll go from there, and he lubed everything up. So I want to thank Bruce. I want to thank Kyle for the feedback, and I want to thank Bruce for his intellectual exchange. Always feel free. Right? Never feel free to contact me. It's a one-way street. No, that if you don't agree with me or you have a different take on something as Bruce had, this is all about education. It's all about learning. So I want to learn, and you learn, and we have you learn, and that's all great. So now it is time for our Bushels and Cents segment. And we will go there, and then we will go to our topic today, which is mechanical procedure. And I will hopefully go through some things on there that will maybe light up a light bulb in your head. Remember the old, if you're old enough, you remember the old Ford ads from the 60s? A lot of you probably don't remember that. I'm showing my age. But I was into cars like from the cradle, into cars and machinery. So I have memories that are older than my calendar years, because I would read, look at Popular Mechanics and Farm Journal and Mechanics Illustrated and Popular Science, and as soon as I could pick up a magazine and look at pictures, and I started to read even before I got into school, because I was so anxious to learn about cars that my mother was teaching me how to read. But anyway, that's near the end of there. So today's Bushel and Cents is all about, as it is every week, that I want to drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool: agronomy, marketing, and machinery. The best way to establish how a poor decision or inaccurate diagnosis of a machinery issue costs your operation money, but instead of referencing just dollars, I will reference it in crop. Corn at $3.50 a bushel. And never forget, it is not what you make, but what you keep that counts. Alrighty, so that's my intro. It's explaining it to new listeners what it's all about. All right, here's our Bushels and Cents conundrum for today. The battery in your planter tractor is about 5 years old, but works fine. You are in the middle of a 1,000-acre field, 3 miles from the home farm. You shut the engine off to eat lunch. When you try to start it again, nothing. The entire electrical system is dead. The battery, due to its age, suffered sudden death syndrome. So just like soybeans, batteries could suffer sudden death syndrome, and I did a show on that sometime last year. The bus bar that ties the cells together broke internally. If you would have load tested the battery over the winter, you would have found the problem. The way you would find the problem is because the tie bar became thin. It wouldn't have the load carrying capacity. That's how you'd be able to detect that. You lost a complete day getting a new battery to the field and did not plant. The next 5 days it rained, and now you are 7 days beyond the optimal planting date, costing you 3.5 bushels per acre on 1,000 acres, or the equivalent of $12,250. And remember, that just became a $12,000 battery because you didn't load test it and do your proper due diligence during the winter. Let this not be you. And for those who may be questioning those numbers, is that historic university data says that, like I said, I'm not an agronomist, but university data says that for each day that you get past the optimal planting window, that it is around a 0.5% of your yield, and I used to come up with those numbers, I used a national yield average of 170 bushels per acre. So regardless if it's a $2,000 hit or a $12,000 hit or a $4,000 hit, because that farmer did not load test that battery during the winter, and he thought, because the tractor cranked fine and did everything fine, that the battery was still in good shape, and he got stuck with it, and that extrapolated out into missing that planting. And that's what this is really all about. It's not the cost of the battery. It's what the failure does to you, and we said in the beginning, not only the financial impact, but the emotional stress. You're in the middle of a 1,000-acre field. You got a call to home. I mean, I wouldn't want to drive on the field with the truck, all right? But, you know, you may have to drive on the field with the truck, bring the battery there, the tools. I mean, it's a nightmare. Now the next day it rains for 5 days and takes two more days to dry out. And bingo, all of a sudden we're really, really behind the eight ball. And that is not good. All righty. So we will continue on. You know, back in the 1980s, I'm going to just grab a drink of water here. On TV, they do it all the time, but I feel uncomfortable doing it on your podcast. There I go. I'm sorry. Back in the 1980s, Mack Trucks had an advertising campaign that said the tagline in the advertising campaign was "Details Make the Difference." You know, when it comes to most things in life, it is the details that make the difference. I mean, you could be a cook, right, in the way you prepare the food, and you could have the same recipe, but if you have a different temperature in the oven or the frying pan, or you do the procedure differently, where you add one spice first instead of the other spice first, or what have you, but the procedure changes, is that those are all little details, and they make a huge difference in the end product, whether the end product is how the food tastes, or you as a farmer, you go in the field to plant, you go in the field to prepare your soil, whatever you may be doing, all right, you're mixing chemical for the sprayer, you know, you keep it agitated, you mix it in the proper order that the instructions say, right, makes a huge difference about the end result. And when it comes to mechanical procedure, details make the huge difference. And the fact is that most lousy mechanics, and I'll use that word, lousy, are not dumb or not unknowledgeable, but they don't apply the proper detail to their work. And if you look at something, and you know, you can look at anything in life, and you know, you could tell when someone's got the details nailed, whether they're really detail oriented or they're sloppy. So what I wanted to talk about today was a list of some mechanical procedure / details that some people overlook. They overlook what they don't think about it. That's good enough. It doesn't make any difference. You know, I hate that saying as an American, good enough for government work. Because, you know, as a taxpayer and as a proud patriotic American, I want my government to be efficient. I want everything to be done to perfection. Not good enough for government work. And I really don't hear that anymore. But I guess growing up, that used to be a line that people used to say, good enough for government work. But I want to start with a little story. If you don't mind, I needed to buy new snow tires for my wife's car, her Escape, and my Fiesta. And she drives about 100 miles a day back and forth to work as a kindergarten teacher. And I put a lot of mileage on, but not necessarily on a daily basis because I work here on the farm. But I do travel a lot for business, and I'm on the road. And like I say, specifically during the winter, I'll put a lot of miles on going to seminars and doing what have you. So our tires were about 3 years old. I think mine had about 70,000 miles on it. Hers did not have that much miles on it. And I always I have them on rims. So it's just a matter of swapping, jack up and swap. And I got Ford rims, so everything is factory tire pressure sensors, everything is factory, bolted right on. I have no problems, no tire pressure sensor issues, and nothing. And I keep the snow tires on the rims, and in the winter I keep the summer tires on the rims in the basement of our house. So this way it's in a controlled temperature environment, and it's not being being soaked with UV radiation or heat soaked someplace, like in the summertime in a shed or something, where all day long it's 120 degrees. And by keeping them inside in a dark environment and a temperature controlled environment, because the rubber lasts a lot longer. And I mean by lasting longer, it stays pliable. So this was the year for new snow tires. And I like Cooper tires. And on my my cars, I've had the good luck with Cooper, and they're one of the only, to a certain extent, American-made tire that's left, all right, and by an American company. So to cut to the chase, I bought four new Cooper tires, snow tires. They had a new model snow tire from what I had. So I said, I'm going to buy that. I usually like to buy a new model tire because, in theory, it should be a new mold, which will make the tire more concentric and round and better. Because if any tire company is going to be outdating a tire and the mold is tired and worn and out of tolerance, or getting out of tolerance, they're not going to invest in a new mold, which is, could be $1 million, at least a few $100,000. They say, hey, we'll get rid of that tire next year, let's just go with this one. So I always usually like to look at a tire line that is new, because I'm assuming that the mold will be new. I know that if somebody's listening from the tire industry, that may be only part of the mold, but hey, I know some of it's going to be new versus old, right? So they had this new snow tire called the True North, and it was a funky looking pattern, tread pattern, was almost off to one side, whatever, so whatever, and so I'll get those and see how they are, how bad can they be, right? And so I ordered those tires, I bought them through the mail, and I ordered them, and they came right in order, and I, as I said, I went to, I spoke about my friend Kurt Mesmer at the Ford dealer, and I bring my old rims there with the tires, snow tires, and ask them to mount and balance these up. Then they have a Hunter Road Force balancer, and I love Road Force balancing because what it does is that it simulates the tire being the weight of the vehicle on the tire rolling down the road and gives it a much more accurate balance, because we could do a whole show on this, but you could have the tire balance, which only means mass equilibrium, the mass is in equilibrium, but the tire could be egg-shaped or out around or what have you and distorting and have a heavier spot that you could balance out, but going down the road you'd have a harmonic vibration. So on this Road Force balancer, what it does is that it tells you how many pounds of road force or pressure it is the tire is exerting against this roller. And I'll go through it quickly so I don't take up too much of your time. And I obviously, the ideal is to have zero, right? Because that means that there's no high spot on the tire that is putting the same. It actually shows the differential. So there's always going to be pressure against the roller when the road force test is evoked, but you're going to show the differential that it's all the same. It doesn't spike up. So what happened was that, so ideally you want zero, meaning no spikes, but the machine kind of accepts in its program up to about 19 or 20 pounds of pressure. Well, the first snow tire we put on for my wife's car, the thing is going crazy like a slot machine. It's not dinging, but the lights are going off. They're like 45 or 50 pounds of pressure. So what you do is you take the tire and you turn it. You turn it on the rim 90 degrees and try it again like you would for a balance. The important message here is that we could not get that tire, when we got that tire below 20 pounds of pressure, it had so much weight on the rim, it looked like it was a silver rim. So obviously, that tire was defective. The next tire was defective also for her Escape, but not to such an extent. So very disappointed. So I'm not going to put these on the car. I'm going to return them. And then I was really disappointed because here it is. Here's my theory of a new mold, and the tire is all screwed up, right? They're expensive tires. I'm not going to buy it. Plus, when I looked at the build date on the tire, when it was built, the tire was already a year and a half old. So I said, why do I want a year and a half old tire that's basically shaped like an egg, and I'm paying almost $200 a piece of them? So I was disappointed because I wanted to get those on the car. But anyway, I said to my wife, we're not putting them on. We'll just deal with it. Put the old snow tires back on. I've got to return these and move forward. And then we'll get to do something about it. You're going to get new tires, but not today. So I came home, I looked at them, and the damn tires were made in China. And I was so disappointed because, and you know, that explained why they were a year and a half old. And to me, that explained why the quality was not the Cooper American quality that I was used to. So I ended up returning them, getting American-made Cooper Evolution snow tires, which I absolutely love. They balanced out beautifully on the Road Force machine. Very quiet, very smooth. But the, you know, why this comes into what I'm saying here with the details make the difference is that today, when you're working on mechanical stuff, there's tools and apparatus and equipment that is available that we did not have years ago. If we would have, if that were not a Road Force machine, and it would have balanced out with only with very little weight, but the tire would have gone and hopped down the road. It would have been hopping down the road. So if they did not have a Road Force type of balancing machine, the tire would have balanced fine, because when we had to put all that weight on it was to try to negate the extra force on the extra road force, not the balance that was without this roller on it. Just the spinning it, you could balance it fine with not much weight, it wouldn't catch your eye. So the thing basically is that when we start to get into working on machinery today, and working on engines and whatever it may be, don't poo-poo the modern technology. And the thing is that, you know, I'm not one who buys into technology just for the sake of buying into it, all right? But as far as diagnostic equipment, tools are concerned or what have you, is there are a lot of procedures today that are much more defined and much more accurate than we used years ago. Years ago, they used to do a bubble balance, right? And then they went to the dynamic, the spin balance, and that was the road force balance. But the reason why I'm telling you this isn't just because the tire is new, and if you're not using your, the shop you use is not using a road force balancer, you honestly don't know whether that tire is truly balanced and true and turning in a circle and not hopping up and down. But the indicator would be that you had the new tires put on, you had them balanced, you go down the road and the vehicle has a hop to it. It has a little above a bounce to it, and the guy says, well, they're balanced fine. Here they are balanced fine, but they're not balanced with a road force on it, simulating as that tire rolls and flattens out as it goes down the road. So keep that in mind. But anyway, that is part of our mechanical procedure. So what I'm going to do is I made a list. I mean, I could probably make a list of 50 things because I'm a pain in the neck as far as mechanical stuff is concerned. I'm very, very, very anal about it. And, you know, years ago in the cowboy days, they'd say that's a one-man horse, that horse only allowed one man to ride him. But with my machinery, my equipment, I'm basically, my equipment is a one-man equipment that, because I'm not saying that I'm the best mechanic in the world, but I have certain procedures that I like to do and different protocols I like to follow, and I don't like anybody else touching my mechanical stuff. Like I said, I'm not saying that they can't do it better than I can, but they may not do it in the way that I want to do it. So what I did is I thought of a list of some things, and like I said, I tried to keep it. I think I have these written down, 15 of them. So we will go through them quickly. And this is my list of pet peeves or mechanical procedure, I should say, that a lot of people do not follow. And hopefully, when I go through this list of 15, that you follow all of them or the majority of them. And then feel free to contact me and give me your list, right? Because I might say, well, that's really something good, and I did not think of it. Okay, so proper mechanical procedure, we could call this. Number one, one of the things that I hate is that when somebody brings bolts down unevenly, and that's not just on crisscrossing on putting a tire on, right? Crisscrossing and you know, going across with the lug pattern, but with anything, right? So the thing is that whenever you are bringing something, bolting two pieces together, connecting two pieces, you need to bring, you don't, first of all, you don't ram the one bolt and ram, and I'll get the impact guns later on in this, but ram the thing down and then try to pull the other side down. You've got to bring it down evenly and snugly. So you bring one side down, to touch a little bit of tension the other side and bring it all down evenly, and then do your final torque or your final tightening. I see so many mechanics put something on, and then and they'll tighten one bolt and tighten another bolt. Even though if they go in a crisscross pattern, they're ramming the thing home or almost home, without bringing it all down together. You know, with tires, not only does that have the ability to warp where the lugs are on the rims, which is on tires and rims, but also today the metallurgy and everything is very, very, very weak because they want to save weight. And then you will actually warp a brake rotor by over-tightening it and not tightening, and even if you don't over-torque it. So if a torque is 70 pounds and you put the wheel and you bring one bolt to one lug to 70 and the others are all loose, then bring another one to 70, you have the ability to warp that. So a pet peeve of mine is mechanics who do not evenly bring to tension the bolts and go in a stepped procedure. Bring it down so it's almost touching. Bring the other one down so it's almost touching, so the two pieces can marry. Then make it touch. So a proper procedure, you're probably going to go around all of those fasteners 3 times at least, and maybe a 4th time. So you're bringing it down evenly, just like with torquing a cylinder head. You're going to go around and you're going to torque it in steps. So that is number one. Number two, not putting anti-seize compound on any thread, and especially spark plugs. I mean, anti-seize compound, you could buy a bottle of a jar is probably a better way to say it, anti-seize compound for $4 or $5. It'll last you 50 years. All right? The thing is that I do not put any fastener on anything without anti-seize compound on it. All right? And the other thing that I also do is I make sure I clean the threads of the fastener and the hole that the fastener, if it's a bolt that's going into a hole, that I need to clean those threads. All right? You know, dirty threads, either on the bolt or in the hole that it's receiving at the female part, will affect the torque rating because you will have it'll seem tight, but it's the binding of the threads in the dirt or the rust. And, you know, today, I put anti-seize compound on anything. I mean, on almost everything. If it's a bolt, if it's a fastener, and I'm going to need to have to, or somebody is going to need to have to take this apart, possibly in the future, I take an alternator apart to put brushes in it or an internal regulator. I put anti-seize compound on those bolts. I mean, you don't gob it up so it goes all over and shorts everything out, but you coat those bolts. And, you know, and it's especially important with spark plugs, because for the most part, spark plugs last so long today because of the ignition systems and the advances in spark plug design. So you could have spark plugs in an engine for 150,000 miles, and depending upon the driving, I pulled the plugs out of my Fiesta at 115,000 miles. I measured them. They were perfect. They were iridium from Ford, but the center electrode it was cut square. It was beautiful. All right, so I might put new plugs in because I bought them, but I wasted my money, $12 a piece. But anti-seize compound there, you don't want to gall the threads. And also, specifically, let's say if you have like an engine that sits outside, and it's going to a seed tender or a tractor or a lawnmower or something, but anything, even if I take it apart every day, anti-seize compound. And you're working on a planter, you have bolts that are going in, anti-seize compound. You're working on a disc harrow, anti-seize compound. Anti-seize compound, and if it's done properly, it's not going to cause any problems, and then it's not going to collect any dirt or what have you, and it makes what would be normally a 5-minute job, if you anti-seize the bolt, when you have to take it apart, if you don't anti-seize it, then it now becomes a job cursing like a drunk sailor and takes you 3 days instead of 5 minutes because you're drilling stuff out. And it's very, very easy. So that's a pet peeve of mine, mechanics who do not put, that's not good mechanical procedure. And, you know, and as I started to say in the beginning of the show, is that you could tell somebody who is attention to a sloppy, and I don't care whether it's a sloppy farmer, a sloppy chef, a sloppy house painter, a sloppy a woman, the way she sloppy laundry, a sloppy the way she cleans the house, or what have you. All right, but the thing is that, and you could tell, and these are sloppy mechanics. Instead of sloppy mechanics, this is, you know, these mechanical procedures that aren't being done are sloppy mechanics. All right. The next thing is, sounds simplistic, but I see it all the time. I see it in the auto repair industry. I see it in farm shops. Not cleaning a funnel before they use it. They have a funnel. They use it to pour oil and hydraulic fluid, whatever it may be, and they don't clean it out before they put it away. So this way it attracts everything. Even if they did clean it, it's been sitting on the shelf. It's got dust. It's collected everything, and they don't clean the funnel before using it. All right? And so you're putting new oil, new hydraulic fluid, new brake fluid, whatever it may be, and you're getting dirt into it. You're polluting it already. Use a clean funnel. I don't care what it's for. Use a clean funnel. I particularly like to use a can of spray brake clean. It's cheap. It's environmentally sound. It evaporates quickly. You spray the brake clean in the funnel. You take a clean shop rag or a clean piece of paper towel. You wipe it all off. I like to hit it again one more time just to make sure I don't have any lint on there, and you're good to go. So always use a clean funnel. Sounds rudimentary, but you'd be surprised how many don't do it. Okay, number four, not checking wheel bearing preload when a wheel is jacked up. If you jack up a wheel that has a tapered roller bearing, like a front wheel on a vehicle or a trailer or something like that, and you're jacking up for some other reason, grab the wheel, the top and the bottom, and try to rock it back and forth. So you're going to push away from you, and in the bottom, you're going to push and pull from the top and bottom. If you have any play in that wheel, then that bearing preload is off. Right, that bearing preload is too loose, and it's usually because of the grease all pushed out of that bearing. So whenever I have the opportunity, like on my cars, you know, I jack them up to change oil, I'll grab the wheel and I'll test it, because, you know, this is all about preventive maintenance. If we could find the problem before it happens, that's great. And it costs you absolutely nothing. You're working on a trailer, pull a wheel off. Not pull the wheel. Just grab the wheel top and bottom and make sure that the bearings are not loose and don't have excessive play in them. 2 seconds it takes to do it. Alrighty, we're up to number five already. Not marking a drive shaft and yoke before removal. You know, this is so common, and then the person goes nuts with it because they're putting universal joints into something, or they're pulling the drive shaft out to do something with the transmission or a bearing seal or what have you. Get yourself a paint pen. Get yourself a white paint pen when you're in town, and keep it in your toolbox and mark the drive shaft. I mark it to the transmission. I mark the yoke to the transmission, the shaft to the yoke, and I mark the shaft to the yoke on the rear of the drive shaft, and then the yoke to the differential. So I have 4 marks on every drive shaft. When you take that out, there's no question that it's going back in the same spot. And, you know, in a lot of these newer vehicles today, even pickup trucks, those drive shafts are so finely balanced that if you don't put them back in the same spot, you're going to have a harmonic. And who the heck wants to be underneath there flipping the drive shaft around 4 times? Takes 2 seconds to mark everything. And this one, if you're putting universal joints in and you're taking the yoke out, then you know that you're putting it back in the proper phase with the shaft. But even if you're not doing that, if you're just pulling the drive shaft out for whatever reason, all right, mark it, mark it. Mark it in 4 different marks. Transmission to yoke, yoke to shaft front. Shaft to rear yoke, yoke to differential. Takes you 2 seconds with a paint pen. The lines could be crooked. They could be whatever. I like to use a white paint pen or a bright yellow one because it stands out and I don't have any trouble seeing it. All right, so mark those shafts. Don't just take them out and worry about it. All righty. The next thing, number 6, a dirty and or loose carburetor. The cleanliness of a carburetor is paramount to how it functions, and the idea that the fasteners are snug and that the fasteners that hold the carburetor together are snug, and that the carburetor is snug to the intake manifold. So whenever you're checking an air filter, you know, a small engine C10, a lawnmower, welder, pump, whatever, you know, clean that carburetor, hit it with some spray carburetor cleaner, go around, snug up the bolts, snug up the fasteners. You don't want to moose them and over-tighten it, but you want to make it snug, and you keep that clean. And not only the exterior part of the carburetor, but clean down in the throat in the venturi, because that's where the air bleeds are. That's where the rubber hits the roads. That's where the mojo happens as the fuel gets pulled out of that carburetor and atomized. So a clean steam carburetor is so easy to maintain. And then you check in the air filter on something, clean the carburetor. You got the air filter off of something, clean the carburetor. And the same thing on an EFI system, though there's not a carburetor, you have something off, clean the throttle plates. Both sides of the throttle plates and the throttle bore. It takes you 2 seconds, two minutes to do it, all right? And you're going to have an engine that's going to be running properly. You're going to have a carburetor that's going to be running properly and give you good service, but you're not building up gum in those air bleeds, in those orifices, all right, in those emulsion tubes. You're keeping it all clean. So simple. But, you know, one of the magazines I write for is Hemmings Muscle Machines, and they show these beautifully restored muscle cars, $150,000, whatever, $200,000, $50,000, whatever the heck number you want to put on. And they take a picture of the guy's engine and the carburetor. They always take it with the air cleaner off. And the damn carburetor is all varnished up. And I said to him about 3 or 4 years ago, if you take the guy's air cleaner, if you can take a picture for the magazine, don't take a picture of a dirty carburetor. Either tell him to clean it or put the air cleaner back on and don't take that picture. But almost every car, you know, these people are telling you about, oh, we got matching code numbers, we got this. We know that Joe Peckerhead, he built this motor on the assembly line in 1963 at Pontiac and blah, 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 blah. And then the goddamn carburetor is all varnished up. It's not going to run right. I don't care about matching numbers and you got the chalk mark on the firewall from 1963 from the Pontiac factory. I care about what the carburetor looks like. And that carburetor shows me when it's dirty like that that you're a lousy mechanic. All right? Simple. I'm not going to candy coat it. All righty. When a V-belt, a serpentine belt, a rubber belt that's installed in a different direction. When you take a belt off, what you need to do is mark which way the belt is. I like to make an arrow so the belt faces me. So you want to put the belt back in the same direction of rotation, because what will happen is that belt will stretch. It'll take a form to that that direction of rotation, the way the load is applied. And if you put the belt on backwards meaning flipped in another direction of rotation, it will usually come off. Jump off even though the bolts are tight, or it will fail prematurely. So every belt, okay, whether it's a lawnmower or a combine, if you're going to put that belt back in service, then mark it and put it back in the same direction of rotation. Okay, we're going to go to number 8, which I kind of discussed about not cleaning before, right, about the anti-seize. You know, don't put together, you know, clean all bolts, And thread holes. I mean, you could use a tap for the thread holes, or lots of times you could just spray it with some carburetor clean or brake clean if it's not corroded, get the dirt out of it. You know, a lot of people say you shouldn't wire wheel a bolt because it takes the protective coating off of it. I've been doing that for years. You don't go and grind it, you gently kiss it, and then if you put a anti-seize compound on it, then you'd have no problem if there was a protective coating. But if it was the protective coating was so good, the bolts wouldn't be corroded, right? So please clean them and visit that again with the anti-seize. Number 9, constantly running a piece of equipment, a car, a truck, anything, running low on fuel. If it's a vehicle or an application that has an electric in-tank fuel pump, that the fuel in the tank is a coolant for the pump. The person that's always running low on fuel, putting $5, $10, put a couple of gallons in here and there, has that pump exposed to air and runs hotter and will have a greatly diminished service life. Plus also is that when you're running low on fuel, you have the potential of aerating the fuel and cavitating the pump and not giving a solid stream. We did a podcast on that, a solid stream of fuel to that engine, that fuel injection system, that carburetor, what have you. But in any application with an electric in-tank fuel pump, I don't care if it's a diesel with a lift pump or a gasoline engine, is that it is designed to be bathed in fuel as a coolant. So yes, you could have the tank full, run it down to empty and fill it up. That's fine, but the person who's always putting $5, $10, a couple of gallons of fuel in there, and that pump is always running exposed, is that you will have a dramatically reduced service life, as I said. But also, what will happen is if the pump starts to go away, you'll have a performance issue because the pump doesn't just go whoop like a light bulb and burn out. As that from that heating of the pump, it'll start to wear excessively. It'll get weaker, and the fuel pressure and fuel delivery will drop. And then all of a sudden, one day, it will just have a die completely. All right, so you're not saving any money. Fill up the tank once, and then if you're a $10 a week guy, fill up the tank once, and then put your $10 in and get so that pump is always covered with gasoline or diesel fuel. Number 10, ignoring ground circuits. Look around all your equipment. Have eyeballs. Know where your ground circuits are. Ground circuits, we did a show on this. Ground circuits are very, very, very important on equipment, especially the more electronics that are involved, because it's a voltage supply in the ground. It's a DC circuit. And I've seen pieces of equipment that the guy is so worried about the paint. He's so worried about this. And I am worried about aesthetics also. I'm an aesthetics guy, but I'm a mechanical guy first. And the thing is, it's got to run right. It's got to be right. And dirty grounds could drive you crazy. We actually did a toolbox test question on that earlier on when we started to introduce that about 2 months ago. So don't ignore the ground circuits, clean and tight, and also look up into that eyelet and do a voltage drop test on the ground, because you can get corrosion up into where the eyelet connects to the wires, and then you will have an excessive voltage drop there, and you will have electrical problems. And with anything with electricity, if anybody tells you, other than having no voltage whatsoever, if anybody tells you they can predict how it's going to react, they're lying to you, all right? Because when you have a bad ground circuit, it could be possibly feeding to another ground circuit. You have drives the electronics crazy, drives things crazy, drives electrical motors crazy. It's not good. So be mindful of your grounds, pay attention to them, and keep them clean and tight. Number 11, impact guns. Hey, on my Christmas show, I spoke about an impact gun. There's a time and place for everything. But you get so many mechanics today that they live just like people live with a cell phone attached to their ear. They live with an impact gun in their hand. I don't like it. I think it's an essential tool. I have an impact gun. It's needed when you need it. It's a proper tool, but it's not for everything. What I don't like about impact guns is that you cannot feel the bolt, and you have a tendency to over-tighten things. But more importantly, you can't feel the bolt, because if you have this powerful impact gun and there's some friction on that bolt or friction on that fastener, you may not be able to tell by the pitch of the exhaust the sound of that impact gun, whereas by hand that you can, or with a breaker bar, with a wrench, what have you, a ratchet wrench. But the thing is that don't use an impact gun. I've seen guys put spark plugs in with impact guns, and you know, look how quick I got it done. And they put a pump together. I saw a guy for a sprayer putting the pump together. And basically, I said that in number three or four on this thing today. The whole housing is cocked, right? And he's going to ram it, try to bring it home on the other side with the impact gun. I mean, so he's not even going and bringing the bolts down. If you don't want to swing your wrist, that's fine, but you have to use that impact gun very gingerly and follow the proper procedure. So you have carpal tunnel in your wrist and you can't swing the wrench. That's fine. I understand that. Then you don't ram the bolts home, but I like to be able to feel a bolt going in and going out. It takes me longer to do stuff, but I do have an impact gun. I'm not saying that they're the devil. There's a time and place for everything, and every bolt on that piece of machinery or engine is not worthy of an impact gun. Alrighty. Number 12, poor gasket surface preparation. Gasket surface preparation, your cleanliness is next to godliness. The surface has to be clean. The surface has to be square or checked for flatness with a steel ruler and a feeler gauge, and we need to make sure it's clean before we put the gasket on. And we don't do and most repairs of gaskets are done haphazardly and sloppily, and all the old gaskets are removed and the surface is not clean properly. Okay, the next one, number 14, prying off a harmonic dampener with screwdrivers, with pry bars, and hammering it back on with a big sledgehammer. No. You end up damaging the dampener, you end up damaging the crankshaft, you're jamming the crankshaft into the thrust bearing. It's not good. you need, if you're going to put, you're going to need to have a harmonic balancer remover and a harmonic balancer installer. They're not expensive. They do it right. They don't damage the harmonic balancer. They don't damage the crankshaft, and you're not going to wipe out the bearings in 100 hours because you rammed it, you hammered the balance wrong with a 5-pound sledgehammer. And then number 15 for today, dirty engine and equipment. Nothing tells, screams more of a sloppy mechanic than a dirty engine and dirty mechanical part. If you don't want to keep the outside polished and waxed, that's fine. But there's people who polish and wax outside, and you open up the hood, you open up the engine bay, the engine cavity on the combine, the thing is filthy, dirty, dusty, dirty, leaky oil, what have you. Remember that dirt works itself into anything. That dirt keeps heat inside the engine, and that dirt also does not allow you to do a good job. You're taking something off, and you have caked grease, and you're putting spark plugs, and you're putting that into the cylinder hole. Into the cylinder bore. So a dirty engine and dirty equipment is a sign of someone who is really not a proficient or excellent mechanic. They're ready. So if you have any questions, hopefully you enjoyed it. Hopefully I didn't hurt anybody's feelings. I really don't care if I did, to be quite honest with you. My goal is to make you the best that you possibly could be, because that's what it is about. In America, we're going to be the best that we can be. And the thing is that you need to be able to take care of your equipment. So hopefully that these tips or these things lit up the light bulb for you. All righty, we're going to move on now to the toolbox test. But first, we're going to have to get ready for that, and we're going to let Tex do that for us. Come on, Tex, let's go.
I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty, then. That's Tex Rubinowitz, Hot Rod Man, on Ripsaw Records. All right, so we're on test number 3, I believe, question number 3. And the way this worked out is actually one of my pet peeves, so you'll probably get this right away. Okay, you just finished changing the alternator on the hay bind and are happy that it can now go back to work cutting the alfalfa before the rain hits tomorrow. It is a beautiful day and you have the AC running and are listening to the radio when suddenly the charge light comes on and the audible warning chimes. You stop the machine and open the hood. The belt is lying there, thankfully not cut up but off the pulleys. You call home for your wife to bring the service truck to the hedgerow and drive over there to wait for her. You think you must have forgotten to tighten the alternator belt bolts, but when she arrives and you grab the wrenches, the bolts are all tight. Why did the belt fall off? You all better get 100% on this, all right? No excuses. Farmer A claims that you put the belt back on in a different direction and that is why it came off. Farmer B states that the bolts came loose on the alternator and they just seemed tight to you with the wrench. Farmer C says that some alfalfa must have got on the pulley and walked the belt off. Farmer D believes that the bearing in the rebuilt alternator is not good and is causing excessive vibration. So put your thinking caps on, guys. But it is not too hard here because we just went over this, and the important thing is for you to understand and learn. Alrighty, so now we are going to go into our special delivery segment, and then I will give you the answer to that toolbox test question. Alrighty, so this is special delivery where people write in and ask a question. And this gentleman writes, "My name is Tom Justin, and I farm in North Dakota. I learned from your podcast about the relationship of tire pressure to the air temperature. That explains a lot of what is happening. My question is, how can I maintain tire pressure during a North Dakota winter on my car and truck? Thank you." Alrighty, what I like to do, and it works out very, very well, you just need to identify a different mean or average temperature for your area. So what I do is I have the piece of equipment or the car, the truck, I wanted where there's no sun load on anything, and the temperature is stabilized. So in my garage, in the morning or what have you, or anytime, as long as it doesn't have a sun load on it, and the temperature is equal. And I take my infrared gun, and I measure the temperature of the tire. So let's say that the temperature of the tire is 30 degrees, all right, and I want 32 pounds in it. So what I do is I identify a nominal temperature. So if I feel that the average temperature in the winter here, day, night, whatever, is 40 degrees, then what I would basically do is I would take the temperature range for that tire. So if Ford says they want to use a mic, Ford wants 32 pounds of pressure, I will make it 32 pounds at 40 degrees. This way, for every 10 degrees Fahrenheit temperature change, the pressure will alter 1 pound. So at 30 degrees, that tire will have 31 pounds. I may say I want 34 at 40 in the dead of winter, so when it's zero, I still have 30 pounds. And then what will happen in the spring as we get towards the warmer weather, I will take some out because the temperature will be higher. So basically, in essence, to answer your question, Tom, is very simple. You're in North Dakota. You may want to normalize your tires to 10 degrees above zero, all right, 20 degrees above zero. So if you say that you want to have 35 pounds at 20 degrees below zero, at 20 degrees, and you have that pickup truck in your farm shop, and it's 40 degrees, so you would need to have, if you want 34 pounds at 20, you would need to have 36 pounds at 40 degrees. So basically, choose a temperature that you will take as your average. But you want to basically, if you go to the low end, so let's say it's minus 20 for a good spell of time, then you would want to adjust that. So you may want to adjust it to zero. You may want to have 34 pounds at 0 degrees. I keep saying degrees instead of pounds. 0 degrees. And then when you get down to minus 20, that 34 will become 32 and the vehicle will be safe to operate. Conversely, if it becomes 40 degrees instead of 20 degrees, then what's going to happen is that you're going to have more air pressure in the tire. But during the winter, it's really not a problem, even if you get a warm day. So the thing basically is for me to say to you succinctly, find the temperature and bring the measure the tire temperature, and then adjust your air pressure to a temperature that you would want at that nominal setting, all right? I use 40 degrees in New Jersey. You may want to use zero in North Dakota or 10 degrees above zero, whatever. But hopefully I was able to explain that to you and it without any, without confusing. Very, very simple. You just want to know what temperature a tire is, because if you don't know what temperature a tire is, you're putting air in, it's useless. That's why people go like to the car dealership and it's 70 degrees in the building and the guy checks the tire pressures and it's 35 pounds and then the lady takes the car home and it sits outside and it's 0 degrees. Well, if it's 70 degrees and that's zero the next morning, she lost 7 pounds and now she has 28 pounds in a tire and the low tire pressure warning light comes on, or you go, you hit a pothole and it takes the bead away from the rim and all the air comes out. So the thing is that for you to check tire pressure, and sadly, I don't know if anybody that teaches it, I'm going to blow my own horn, but me, is that you need to know what the temperature of the tire is, and specifically in the winter when you get big temperature swings, you have to compensate for that. In the summer, it's not so bad because you could say, well, I live in Arizona, I'm going to use 90 degrees as a nominal value. If the tire gets to be 110 or it gets to be 80, it's going to be fine. But in the winter, if you're putting air in that tire at 60 degrees sharp and it's zero outside at 10 below zero, that tire is going 7, 8, 9 pounds off. And you've got problems. So if you have any questions on that, Tom, or anybody else, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And the answer to our question, ding, 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 is Farmer A. And you better have all gotten that right, because we covered that in my mechanical procedure on today's show. Farmer A claims that you put the belt on in a different direction, and that is why it came off. Very, 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 very common. So listen, I want to thank you all for tuning in today. I hope that you enjoyed it, and I want you to know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher in my beloved, beloved America. You have a blessed day, and I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to smoke my tires. I'm going to roll some coal, and we're going to hit it hard, baby. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.